Puram saranam gacchami. Puram saranam gacchami duryampi. Puram saranam gacchami tatyampi. Dhammam saranam gacchami duryampi. Dhammam saranam gacchami tatyampi. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami duryampi. Sangham saranam gacchami tatyampi. Sangham saranam gacchami. Almost every retreat that I've ever been on starts with taking the refuges, the three jewels of Buddhism. The three jewels are the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The words, I take refuge in the Buddha, again I take refuge in the Buddha, for a third time I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma, again I take refuge in the Dhamma, and for the third time I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. Again, I take refuge in the Sangha, and for a third time, I take refuge in the Sangha. And so in today's talk, I'm going to explore what that means and why it might be a useful reminder that we can live our lives in a more thoughtful, compassionate, and communal way. The historical Buddha was a wandering teacher. He was also apparently a reformer and a social critic. The purpose of his teachings was to reduce suffering. And we need to see what that means. The first noble truth of Buddhism is that we constantly encounter a world that is different from the way we want it to be. This is called dukkha. And in the Buddha's words, as they've come down to us, remembering that the Buddha did not write anything down, and so it was years later. So dukkha is often translated as suffering. I prefer another term for it, that things are not causing us suffering, but dissatisfaction. And I think that many of us might sort of pull back from suffering. Do I really suffer? But boy, dissatisfaction, I know that one. You know that one? We all know that one. So in the words of the Pali Canon, birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha, encountering what is not dear is dukkha, separation from what is dear is dukkha, not getting what one wants is dukkha. In short, these five bundles of clinging are dukkha. So, nothing very mystical, unusual, out of the ordinary about all that. As others have said, the full catastrophe is dukkha. Dukkha contains things we don't even want to think about. How about the three messengers, sickness, old age, and death? We have choices, however, and this is where Buddhism is, to me, so useful. We can often unthinkingly, automatically react to what life presents us. So, as a teenager, I wandered around with a chip on my shoulder. You can't imagine that, I'm sure. None of you have ever wandered around as teenagers with chips on your shoulders. And I had some special gifts to help me with this particular chip. I had a large vocabulary, a largely insensitivity towards the feeling of others, and if you put those together, you get somebody who is very pleasant to be around most of the time. So the Buddha suggests a different way by encouraging us to try to see what our reactions really are. We most likely either want something we don't have, don't want something we do have, or are clueless about what's happening. I've never been clueless myself, of course, so I can't identify with that particular. So still, we're dissatisfied, we suffer, because we are not in tune with reality and spend our time and energy wanting reality to be different from what it is. Taoism gives us the metaphor of the river. The river is always moving, and it doesn't care whether we like that or not. We can choose to go with the river, or stand against it, or ignore it, but it flows on anyway. The Buddha urges us to become aware of our bodies, our thoughts, our emotions. His enlightenment was to see his own reactivity and see it again, and again, and again. The story goes that the Buddha, having tried various ascetic practices, decided to sit under the Bodhi tree until he figured out just what there was about the human condition that led to such dissatisfaction. During that time, he was assailed by the forces of Mara. Now, Mara is an interesting figure in Buddhism, but every religion probably has a Mara. Mara is a tempter. So Mara sent his daughters to try and seduce the Buddha. Mara is a judge. "Who are you," he asked the Buddha, "to become a more enlightened being?" Mara is actually those voices within which keep us riled up. They are the places we are stuck. In Western thought, maybe the seven deadly sins are among the forces of Mara. We all have them, and they are not our friends. When was the last time an inner voice told you how handsome, how beautiful, how smart, how compassionate you are? When did it say, "Hey, there's a hole there, don't step in it," instead of, "Hey, stupid, didn't you see the hole?" We have a whole mental drama going on most of the time, and it keeps us from living in the moment as it rehashes our mistakes and lost opportunities, or rehearses what we are going to do the next time. Under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha answered Mara's challenge of his right to see clearly by striking the earth and asking the earth goddess to vouch for his right to see, to be there and to enjoy clear sight. And with that, with the striking of the earth and the goddess granting these things, Mara departed, but only for a while. He would come back, and the Buddha understood what he could see in the end of his reactivity, again, for the moment. Morning came, and the Buddha, having attained insight into the process of his own mind, arose and walked through a nearby village. The villagers, seeing this luminous being, asked, "Are you a man?" And the Buddha said, "No." "Are you a god?" And the Buddha said, "No." "Then what are you?" And the Buddha said, "I am awake." The Buddha was a man, of course, but an awakened man. He was now able to take on his life and his life's work, which he had originally not wanted to do, protested against, and postponed. That sound familiar? Don't like it, protest it, postpone it. He realized that his life work was to teach. And his teaching was how to live more comfortably. The former Buddhist monk and scholar Stephen Batchelor sums up the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha as: embrace life, let go of what arises, see the ceasing of what arises, and then act. And so, to take refuge in the Buddha, the first jewel, is to accept one's life and try to see it as clearly as we can. That seeing includes our own reactivity and the possibility of not being governed by or at the mercy of its whims. And also some tools: the Noble Eightfold Path of compassionate understanding, compassionate aspiration, compassionate speech, something I didn't have as a teenager, compassionate self-discipline, compassionate livelihood, compassionate endeavor, compassionate mindfulness, and compassionate awareness. And it is to embrace these things. That is the aspiration of taking refuge in the Buddha. It is not worshiping the man. It is not worshiping the image. It is an understanding that someone else did this thing, and it's a good thing to do, and I can try and do it also. I take refuge in the Dhamma. Dhamma, same as Dharma, one is Pali, one is Sanskrit. It's variously translated as the truth, the law, the reality. It's the Taoist river, which keeps going, regardless of our thinking about it, our wanting it, our not wanting it, our standing in it, our spitting in it. It goes its own way. The Dhamma is the reality of what is. The Buddha came to understand that we will never be able to see ourselves and our place in things clearly until we had accepted the conditional nature of life's unfolding. Something never comes out of nothing. It comes out of something else. And in speaking to a wanderer, the Buddha, of course, wandered all over the place. The Buddha said, "Let be the past, let be the future. I will show you the Dharma. When this is, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this is not, that does not come to be. With the ceasing of this, that ceases." You plant an apple seed, and you never, ever, 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 ever get a mango. You might love mangoes, you might not like apples, but you plant an apple seed, and that's what you're going to get. Without getting into a metaphysical discussion of karma or reincarnation, we can still understand that there is a law of cause and effect. The Western saying is that as you sow, so shall ye reap. We are conditioned beings. Our genetics, our upbringing, our life experience, our mental and physical worlds, and the ongoing natural and social world all affect what we can do, what we want to do, and our interior comfort with the reality in which we are embedded. There is a lot of what we are and what we confront over which we have little control. So, my parents, my dad was 5'4", my mom was 5'3", and now in my elder haghood, I am 4'10". I once was 5 foot, but those days are gone. In any case, even in my glorious 5'1.5" splendor, grandeur, I was never going to be a basketball player. Didn't matter. But the trivial example points to an important truth. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. And you cannot get something out of nothing. The Buddha saw the conditioned nature of all things, but he also saw that the way to freedom lay not in changing the underlying reality, but its definition. It can't be changed. But our relationship to that reality can change, and that is where we can exercise some control. I've had my heart set on many things in my life, on people, accomplishments, material comforts, luxuries. I have gotten some of these. I haven't gotten others. And does anyone here have a different experience? One thing has become clear, that when I try to move heaven and earth to get something, it's really a bad idea. There's a reason, whatever it is, that it does not come easily. And my desire for it blinds me to the cold, hard facts of what it is, what I am, what needs are. Does this mean that in the face of injustice, I shrug and say, well, that's the way it is? No, it does not mean that. We live a fuller life, and we live a life in Buddhist iconography between the wings of compassion and wisdom, compassion and wisdom. And each tells us when to act. Sometimes our efforts pay off, and sometimes they don't. The reactivity lies in being wedded to the outcome. We do our best. And if we can just think about it objectively, you can't do better than your best. We do our best and we accept the outcome of that effort. And we accept it with a certain gladness and we accept it with a certain dignity. I take refuge in the Dhamma when I am willing to see what my own reactions are to the reality of the situation. Longer meditation retreats have given me a front row seat to the what I like to call the Mara dog and pony show. You know that thing I said to whoever it was 25 years ago? Well, now here it is right in front of me in the silence sitting on my cushion. And it's going to continue to do that. It's going to come back. It's going to say, you know, you really did a stupid thing. You know, you're probably going to do it again. Why can't you ever learn? Or sometimes I can hear my grandmother's voice. It's really interesting when that happens. She was a backseat driver to my grandfather. The fact that she had never driven a car in all of the 98 years she lived didn't stop her. So when we confront ourselves in the silence, up come the fears, the angers, the stories which have repeated themselves over and over again. In my better moments, I, like the Buddha, can invite Mara in for tea, and maybe we'll have time for that story. Old friend, it's you again. I know you. I've been sitting for 35 years, and for 35 years, here you are. Maybe we should call a truce, even if we can't sign a peace treaty. And in daily life, I can sometimes see my reactivity in time, and as we used to say, engage brain before putting mouse in gear. Compassion, wisdom. The first sentence of my cultural anthropology textbook was that humans are social animals. We would not need an eightfold path or much else of the Buddha's teachings if we did not somehow have to live together. The Buddha lived a peripatetic life, but he did not live it alone. He was part of a community, the Sangha. There is disagreement, going back to the time of the Buddha, over who should be included in the Sangha. Some thought it was only those who had renounced secular life. Some narrowed it down to men who renounced secular life. Others thought it should include anybody who agreed with a Buddhist worldview and was trying to live their lives accordingly, even if they still lived in the world. And many of the stories in the Pali Canon involve the Buddha talking to those people. They're called householders. They are not monastics. Our own heritage is one of community. The Jewish community can practice the rituals that make it Jewish only when 10 adults are gathered, the minyan. Jesus was joined in his wanderings by his disciples. And just like a Jewish congregation or a gathering around Jesus, so did the Buddha have his adherents, but also his fellow travelers and the curious. I belong to this congregation, but also am a member of the practice community at Southern Dharma Retreat Center, which is a group of people who are committed to some sort of meditative practice and own hermitages on land adjoining the Southern Dharma Retreat Center. We meet four times a year to renew our bonds to one another and to take care of business. It used to be the roads and the sewage system. We think we've got some of that in hand after 12 years. I also belong to the Insight Meditation Community of Colombia, which meets in our library every Monday night. 6:30 is for meditation instruction. 7 begins a half-hour sit. 7:30, a little Dharma talk like this one. You are all welcome. It's free. We're on Meetup. So, a Buddhist community. One of the three pillars of Buddhism, one of the three refuges, one of the three jewels, and according to the Buddha, the most important one. We cannot do it without one another. As we read earlier, we need one another. Humans are ill-equipped to live alone. We don't have teeth or claws. We aren't very big or strong. We cannot run very fast. What we have is intellect, opposable thumbs, but so do raccoons. And we have strength in numbers. Community can be a mixed blessing. As we see in our politics of the moment, the country is sharply divided. Communities, by definition, have boundaries which separate the us from the them. The Buddhist Sangha was meant to be supportive of those traveling the path. It is easier to act well when those around one share the same vision of what acting well means. It's harder to do so when they do not. We all need gentle nudges now and then from those we respect, especially if they see us wandering away from the ways of compassion and wisdom. The Sangha is the third jewel, and yet the Buddha never meant for the community to be a fetter on reason and free inquiry. And that's a difficult task. We here in the UUCC should ask ourselves what we mean by community and what our boundaries are. Where should we be tolerant and where should we stand firm and what does each of those things mean? Our last hymn is based on the Buddha's last words as he lay dying. He knew that communities tend to ossify and that in the end we are both social creatures but also individual thinkers. If we give up our critical faculties, then we no longer have any of the three jewels. So I'll end with a story about Mara and the Buddha, but I won't read it because it's too long. So I'll just tell it to you. So Buddha's in a cave meditating, and outside, sort of standing guard, is his nephew and caretaker, Ananda. And Ananda in these stories is sort of a foil, and the term is no-no Ananda. No, Ananda. So Ananda's out there. Excuse me a moment. And who should come wandering up the path but Mara? Because Mara's bored. And so Mara comes up and Ananda says, "Get away from here. Nobody wants you, Ananda. You just cause trouble and, you know, who needs you at this point? You know, the Buddha is trying to meditate, blah, blah, blah." And the Buddha hears this and comes out and he says, "Oh, Mara, my old friend. Mara, haven't seen you in a while. You've been okay? Come on in for tea." So Ananda goes off skulking and Mara comes in and sits down for tea. And the two old friends talk to one another and Mara says, "You know, I just want to give it up. I just can't take this anymore. I don't want to be Mara anymore. You know, I need to go and torment people and, you know, always find ways to cause them to forget who they are and to act badly. And, you know, it's a real drag to be Mara." And the Buddha says, "Old friend, you don't know the half of it. You think it's fun to be a Buddha? Here all you want to do is, you know, sort of spread the understanding you have and people build you all these temples and make you all these offerings and talk about things you never did and never would do. And before you know it, they're worshiping you and you're supposed to behave yourself all the time. It's really, you know, who wants to do that?" And so the two old friends have tea, clink cups, commiserate about their fates as Mara and Buddha. And in time, Mara leaves, and Ananda says, "Why are you entertaining Mara?" And the Buddha says, "We are all Mara. We are all Buddha." And with that, thank you. Please stand. Thank you.